Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist. Join me as I seek out the small incremental changes being applied in other industries that we can learn from and that can be applied in healthcare. Can these changes bring immediate value, but also add up to the big improvements and revolution we need in healthcare? Come along with me to explore the possibilities. My innovative guests from around the globe have used small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot.
And today, I'm delighted to be joined by Jay Sultan. He is the Vice President of Strategy of Healthcare in LexisNexis. Jay, thanks for joining me today.
It's a pleasure to be here, Dr. Nick.
So, as I do with all my guests, I think it's important to get a little bit of context of you, the individual, how you arrived at this role, little bit about your background. Tell us how you got here and some of the highlights in your career, if you would.
I'd be glad to. So I'm from rural Georgia and grew up in a fairly technologically backward part of the state. Got into computers and software. I'm not a clinician by background. I am a technologist. I often joke I've had every job you can have in a software company, including having owned one at one point. And I got introduced into healthcare IT as a result of my first wife going through and losing a five-year battle with cancer. I was in my 30s at that point and was astounded at, you know, my experience as a caregiver, seeing all the challenges and all the kind of experiential things that she and I went through that just really, to me, felt like a system in need of improvement. And so a good friend of mine had an idea for innovation in healthcare. It involved computers. He knew that, just give him a call out. His name is Dr. Clint Ashford. And he had an idea for how to do an innovation in healthcare, but wasn't a software person, didn't know how to get started. So that was my introduction to healthcare IT. And I'd say maybe 15 years ago, 10 years ago, I got lost. I found myself talking to attorneys more often than I was talking to programmers. And I realized I'd crossed over to the policy side of healthcare IT. So I've had a number of jobs in startups. I've had a number of roles working either as a product owner or as an advisory consultant over the last few decades. My career has been about 50-50 payer provider, which is unusual for somebody that has my background. And pretty much all the opportunities I've had working at different companies have all been around the idea of innovation, not just technology innovation, but how do we innovate healthcare? How can we make healthcare better, cheaper, easier, more effective, more evidence-based, more better coverage? Those kind of questions and the real-world technology meaningfully applied at the payer, at the provider, in the hospital, in the workflow, that's really where my career has been about.
Fantastic. Thank you for that. So first of all, I'm deeply sorry to hear about your wife and your intersection with the healthcare system. You know, there's no making up for that. There's no excusing it. People's origin story are always a surprise to me, and yours certainly was. So thank you for sharing that.
I raise it just to make the observation that, you know, as somebody who thinks like an engineer and thinks about systems, I was very surprised at the things the system wasn't set up to handle. For example, she got reconstructive surgery before she had her radiation treatments. Now, there's no doctors in the world that I know of who would think that's the right solution or the right sequencing, because of course the radiation damaged the work done by reconstruction. But there was, you know, we as, you know, 30-year-olds didn't know how to navigate the process. And our, you know, siloed, uncoordinated touches with different parts of the healthcare system. You know, the surgeon focuses on what the surgeon does. That's what the surgeon's incentivized to do. That's the rules of the game. He's playing by the rules of the game. But the experience, at least to a patient, is, you know, we've known for a while now that this is an area that we as an industry need to address. And so, you know, losing her was traumatic. If she'd survived, I probably would have the same thought. And that is that as a system, you know, I am the last to advocate for single payer or government run delivery system. But at the same time, our for-profit free market oriented system is in need of improvements. And these are improvements we can make that I think will both not only benefit our patients, our members, but they'll benefit us in the healthcare industry. It'll make us more profitable. It'll streamline things. It'll take friction out of the system. So there's, you know, the great thing about a $4.3 trillion industry is you don't have to make much change to have real dramatic impact. And that's really been the philosophy, you know, that I've had through my career is how do we make systematic structural changes that benefit everyone? Because there's a lot of win-win-wins out there.
I got to say, I love that. You know, you don't have to make a lot of change in those numbers to get my preferred term, incremental changes. But those are like enormous changes and hugely positive. And I think extraordinarily important to sort of focus in on those origin stories and the reasons why, because passion drives this industry and drives people in it. And, you know, it's a drive for good in my view. So I really appreciate you sharing it and also sharing the additional details. So thank you for that. You had talked a little bit about the future. And, you know, one of the things that you referenced as part of your introduction was the sharing of information, interoperability. And I think you sort of declared the battle has been won. We have a new interoperability and patient access rule. Things are going to get better. What's your feeling about that now?
So you're referring to something I said in December of 2020. And here we sit in June of 2021, just days away from the next part of the 21st Century Cures Act rulemaking taking place, which will be the publication of the patient access API for the payers. I stand by the view that by the end of 2021, I think as an industry, we will be surprised at how far we moved during 2021. And I think the seminal event will be, number one, the publication of the patient access API, which, just to remind people, it doesn't affect every insurance company. It affects four named lines of business: Medicare Advantage, Managed Medicaid, CHIP, and QHPs, which most people know as Obamacare, that operate on the federal exchange. Those make up about 40% of the U.S. insured population. So for 40% of the U.S. insured population, any application developer, anybody who wants to write an app, but much more importantly, any existing business, any existing entity inside of healthcare, and any existing entity outside of healthcare will be able to get consent from a patient, and with that consent, access a highly standardized data set that is broad, that is deep, and that is very rich, and be able to do so in a remarkably consistent way across roughly 350 different payer organizations that are governed by and regulated by this rule. So that's an awfully big statement, and it's completely unlike anything that we could have said about meaningful use, about the adoption of HIEs or RIOs. And I think some of the key tenets as to why, I haven't told you yet maybe what I think the impact will be, but defending the idea about why that impact will happen is, first and foremost, there was action by the federal government. And I am not often a fan of action by the federal government personally, but in this case, it was necessary. The federal government's the largest payer in the world by both dollars and many other measures. And only they have not only the power of the purse as, you know, the principal payer for more than 50% of most providers' revenue stream, but also the power of regulation. And they are using both of those in this instance to compel change. And so if you don't mind me extending the analogy just a bit, Dr. Nick, I think a lot about what has and hasn't happened in healthcare that worked. I often say that the new interoperability, which in my mind is different than what we've done in the last 10 years, what we've done with meaningful use, which was not use that was meaningful, what we've done with the HIEs and the RIOs, it's not that they've had zero benefit or impact, but they certainly haven't accomplished what we hoped they would accomplish, which again, for me, for some stakeholders, is the idea that data should flow freely where and as it's needed to provide effective, efficient, quality healthcare in a way that still respects the privacy and the individual control that patients and members should have. So that, in my mind, is really what we should be about. And that was, I think, the goal for meaningful use. I think that was the goal for HIEs, but it's largely not happened. And I think about, well, what has worked? And that causes me to make the following statement. We have some interoperability in healthcare today that works pretty well. We just don't call it interoperability. We call it the EDI, or sometimes we call it the RCM, the revenue cycle management. It's the flow of claims. It's the data flow that handles the payment of healthcare. Because I'm old enough to remember the days before HIPAA. And pre-HIPAA, it's not that electronic claims didn't exist. Payers and providers had computer systems, but there were no standards. There were no mandates. There was no uniformity. And so what would happen is one payer and one hospital would get together and make a point-to-point connection, a data trade. I like to talk about trading data. They would do it, but it wasn't scalable beyond that one relationship. And the government said, this is crazy. There's a standards body I like. They're called X12. They got a family of standards I like called 4010. Now we have 5010. And I don't like all the standards, but I like this 837. I like this 835. I'm going to mandate those. Now, this was before this rule took place. People thought that because remember, at the time, while there were a few hospitals doing electronically, the vast majority were either starting with paper and sending paper to the payer, or they were starting with the computer. They were using the computer to create paper or fax, and they were sending that to the payer, right? That was the world we lived in. And people thought, well, this is going to be a big deal, but maybe it's not going to like completely change the way we treat. It's not going to cause us to organize our hospital differently. And I would argue that's, in fact, exactly what happened. That, you know, it's been attributed to many people. I choose Bill Gates. He says that in the technology world, we always underestimate what we can accomplish in 10 years, but we always overestimate what we can accomplish in one. I feel like the EDI, the process, electronic processing of claims, is a great example of that. Because in the first year, there were incredibly low auto adjudication rates. People were having to change systems. They're having to train armies of new people to do coding in new and different ways that we had never done before. It was incredibly expensive. It was incredibly disruptive. But what comes out of it now is we've gone from auto adjudication rates, you know, around 10 to 15% to where most payers are able to auto adjudicate around 85 to 90%. And that matters to everybody. It matters because of the volume of claims we process. We couldn't go back to paper today if we wanted to. There's just not enough people, scanners, whatever, to be able to process the volume of claims, nevertheless, the complexity of claims that we have today. And so when we think about new funding models of how, you know, outpatient surgical centers work and how they get compensated in ways that add value to the system, when we think about this, you know, kind of longitudinally, we see all these places where have we never had electronic claims, we would have never been able to see the system change the way that it has. And remember, I'm not talking yet really about the treatment of healthcare. I'm talking about the payment of healthcare. So the EDI worked so much so today that we would struggle to do without it if like it were to get withdrawn for some reason. And that is interoperability. You have thousands and thousands of providers sending information to hundreds of payers, and it all works largely without humans having to touch it. And I would argue that it actually benefits all of us. For providers, every time, you know, a payer can't auto-adjudicate, the provider has to spend money on, you know, touching it and calling and delayed payment and. The free flow, people were skeptical in the zero-sum world of paper claims, where they said, well, my ability to process claims at a higher volume gives me a competitive advantage over. Now, I, as a hospital, have a competitive advantage over my payer because I can, you know, because of the way the paper claims work. And they felt like they were potentially losing that advantage. I feel like that's where we are today. There's a number of stakeholders in the industry who I believe have not been enthusiastic about the meaningful free flow of data for the treatment of healthcare. This is what the 21st Century Cures Act targets, is the data needed for the treatment and the operation of healthcare. And I could argue they do that because they're concerned about the future and about losing their current competitive advantage. And I think that that's going to prove to not be the case.
So for those of you just joining, I'm Dr. Nick, the incrementalist. Today I'm talking to Jay Sultan. He is the Vice President of Strategy for Healthcare in LexisNexis. We were just talking about the rollout of interoperability and specifically the new API that's coming through the Cures Act and the value proposition. Just to dive in a little bit, you made a couple of statements around those fearful of sharing this information. Many would say that some of that failure of interoperability was not about technology, although some of it was, but a fair proportion of it was economic fear of loss of business. You've taken a subset, as you define clearly, the four lines of business and the 40% that is being addressed, which, to your point earlier on, is a huge impact, when you consider the size of the healthcare system. What about the remaining 60%? Do you think those are cards that are going to fall, and why?
Well, we know those cards will fall. It requires getting a little bit technical about how the law is put together. So let me give you maybe three or four bullet points on the 60%. The first point I'd make is this. I think even in the first year or two of the payer part of the patient access API rule operating, we will see payers voluntarily starting to support all their lines of business. And a few of them are mission oriented. They'll do it because they think it's the right thing for their members or for healthcare. I think for most of them, they'll do it because of the effect of the employers. Remember, the principal customer that most payers care about are employers. If you're an employer and you're used to paying, far more for healthcare than a Medicaid plan does, and you're being told patients on the Medicaid plan can access their data, but patients in my expensive employer plan can't, I think employers will start to bring pressure to bear on their payers to expand that, voluntarily without the mandate. I also think we're likely to see a TEFCA rule out of the new administration somewhere in the next 6 to 12 months. And I think that has the potential to, again, significantly disrupt what all of us think. But I don't want to guess at what TEFCA is going to say. So I'm just going to comment that TEFCA could be something else that ends up altering the picture of what data can be accessed and by whom and when and how. The next point I want to get to, though, is a very important date if you work for a hospital system or a physician. And that's January 1st, 2023. By the current rule, assuming there's no more changes to the rule, and I see no indication to think that we will see this changed or delayed, on January 1st, 2023, every certified EMR must support the patient access API for providers. Now, the patient access API for providers is very similar to the API for payers. In particular, they both use the same Smart on Fire workflow. What is that? The Smart on Fire workflow is a standardized process whereby anybody who wants to access this data, whether it's two app developers in a garage in San Jose, or it's a major payer or a major hospital system, whoever it is that wants to access the data can go through a standardized set of steps against any payer, and then starting in 23, against any provider, again, that has a certified EMR, and be able to validate that they should have access to the data, get the consent needed from the patient slash member, and be able to create that technical connection. It's also similar in that they both contain the US CDI, or sometimes known as the US Core. There's a slight difference between those two, but for this conversation, let's call them synonymous. And the US CDI is a very broad and deep and very, very well developed, in my opinion, set of standards and specifications, far better than the CCDXs that we worked with for 8 or 10 years, because they're far more prescriptive, they're far broader, and they do a far better job of bringing context and metadata that allow automated systems to simply take the value and start using it, rather than to have to do lots of, again, specific to one trade, one data trade work, figuring out how to make the data meaningfully go from one place to the other. So it's that we have this great US CDI that's not only got all this great specification in it, but it's very, very broad. It includes notes. It includes a large set of structured data around everything from lab results to meds to problems. I mean, I'm going to forget the number off the top of my head, but 20-something resources that are richly defined in this standard. And it'll be the most comprehensive, standardized data set we've ever worked with as an industry. And so I say that to make the point that the data that it will allow us to transport from a provider, from a hospital, from a doctor, is identical to the clinical portion of the data of the payer access API. Now, the payer access API also has claims, it has encounters, it has some benefit information about pharmacy. But I think the game changer is the fact that any entity that wants to collect data about a person, whether that's me as a patient, whether it's an app that I've chosen to use, or whether it's a company that I'm doing business with, a payer, a hospital, or Walmart, or Amazon, they can all use the same technology to access the same format of data from all the different silos where it lives. And so I see this July 2021 date where the payers go live as the beginning of a training period when people will start to prepare for January 2023, when it's available on any patient, regardless of the line of business, any patient who has data inside of an EMR that's certified.
Very cool. I'm excited, and you know, I think the pathway is laid out, and it feels like, you know, there are some solid guardrails that are going to get us there. In the closing minute or so that we have, you mentioned that we have enough in the way of data standards, you know, the elements. My sense is that it's never perfect. Do you think there's still pathway and opportunity to expand that? What are we going to do to build on that?
Well, without question. And one of the smart ways that the government and HL7 and the organizations out there like DaVinci and Karen and all the others that have been working so hard on this have done is they've given us a standard, and the government's given us a mandate on that standard to get us all started on the same place. These standards are designed to be future compatible, future forward working, so we can make changes to them without breaking everything. And there are established stakeholder groups that are constantly meeting to figure out how to improve it. So I just mentioned the US CDI will be implementing V1 initially. They've already figured out, and they're balloting, I think, somewhere later this year on the V2. And eventually, I hope we'll see a mandate that we all have to move to the V2. And these are designed to make it so that these can be living, breathing standards. The standards themselves are set up with capabilities. And as it gets technical, the fire standards we're talking about have the ability to do extensions and to support metadata about provenance and stuff. And all of that extra effort built into the standards makes them both standardized and flexible in the ways that we need. Really, Fire 4.0 is going to replace all the previous versions of Fire, but also, in my mind, the HL7 2.0 CCD, CCDXs, and the HL7 3.0 ADTs, ORUs, stuff like that, because it's such a better standard. And it is a standard that, you know, we've had the 837 standard for 35 years now. Now, I want to point out, it has changed over time. I mean, we've modified every year that standard changes. But we as a system are great at adopting and handling those changes. I think it'll be the same thing with the US CDI and the other related fire standards. And I also think we will see more mandates. This administration is going to want to focus on public health. We're going to probably have mandates around SDOH, maybe the gravity standard that's in final stages of being developed. So I think we will see it extended as the business needs of all the constituents drive it. And again, there has to be a healthy place for the government to make sure that we are moving together as a group. Without that, I don't think we'll be successful.
Fantastic. I unfortunately, as usual, we've run out of time. You know, what's extraordinary to me is I have lots of conversations. Most people are pretty passionate about, you know, the future. If anybody ever pushes back in terms of interoperability, I am going to refer them directly back to you, because it is clear to me you see that vision, you can see the pathway. And I think it's extraordinarily important. We missed that completely with meaningful use and a number of other things. But I see that and I love it because you've come from the technical side with a passion around healthcare. And I think it's just so important for us to get to that position. So, Jay, thank you for sharing all of this. It's been a real pleasure talking with you. And I know our listeners are going to really enjoy the insights and the passion.
Thank you, Dr. Nick. It was great to join you and your guests.
Thanks for joining me today. Do you have any better ideas, or have you found a small incremental change that's brought about a big improvement in your world? Let's continue the conversation on our hashtag, TheIncrementalist, or share with me at DrNick1 on Twitter. You can find more information about the show on our program page at healthcarenowradio.com. And tune in next time to hear my discussions with leaders and innovators from around the globe who've revolutionized their space by using small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot. I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist, and I'm starting a revolution through evolution.